In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast. Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Leonardo, a new drama about the life of Leonardo da Vinci, has been released on Amazon Prime in the UK and Ireland this week. Starring Aidan Turner, it's an eight-part series reimagining Leonardo's life, work, influences and relationships. Ahead of the show's release, we spoke to Catherine Fletcher, a historian of Renaissance and early modern Europe and professor of history at Manchester Metropolitan University, to find out more about the artist's real relationships and what can be found in the historical record. Putting the questions to Catherine was our acting digital editor, Eleanor Evans.
Catherine, thank you so much for joining us on the History Extra podcast today.
Hello, good to see you.
And we're going to be talking today about Leonardo da Vinci. And the jumping off point for our conversation today is that there is a new drama about Leonardo starring Aidan Turner of Pole Dark fame. And it's on Amazon Prime in the UK and Ireland at the moment. And Catherine, you joined us last year to talk about your book, The Beauty and the Terror. And in that conversation, you talked a lot about viewing the Renaissance and its great art in its social context. And I wonder, to start off, could we do the same for Leonardo, to give listeners a bit of a refresher of when he was working at and the backdrop that he was working against?
Yes, absolutely. So Leonardo was born in 1452. He's known as Leonardo da Vinci because of his connection with the village of Vinci, which is outside Florence in Tuscany, up in the hillside. It's very pretty. His father was a notary, a lawyer, Ser Piero da Vinci, and his mother was a local peasant girl. They were not married. This seems to be a fairly classic case of Ser Piero going back to visit his family for a short-term visit, getting it on with one of the local girls. She gets pregnant, and the grandparents actually take on bringing up the baby and bringing up the uncle, and the uncle helps as well. So Leonardo evidently takes an interest in art, and as many young men with an interest in art do, he goes into a workshop in Florence, in this case the workshop of Andrea del Verrocchio, who's a very established Florentine artist, and gets his training there. So this takes us into the world of Florence in around the kind of 1460s, 1470s, when Florence is one of the major states on the Italian peninsula. So at this point in time, Italy wasn't all one country. It was divided into five quite big states and a number of smaller ones. So the big ones are Naples, the Papal States run by the Pope from Rome, Florence, Venice and Milan, and then there are lots of other little duchies and marquisates and so on scattered about, all with their own courts, all with their own kind of artistic ambitions. And there's a lot of competition between the rulers of these small states for artists to produce material for them, and indeed also for scientists and engineers. If we think about the other side of Leonardo's career, part of the reason he's in demand is because he's able to work on the military side of things, work on the architectural side of things too. So he is in this very wealthy part of Europe where there's a lot of money to pay for art, which is a good position to be in for an up-and-coming Renaissance artist.
And how does he come to get on the radar of some of these families, of these ruling courts?
Well, in Florence, obviously, he's already working for somebody who is noticed and who is prominent. But there's also, a good deal of diplomatic exchange between these different courts. So when he goes off to Milan, he almost goes as on a sort of diplomatic mission from the Florentine government, and then he gets headhunted by the Duke of Milan and convinced to stay. So there's a certain amount of competing with better offers, with better stipends for people to be your court artists. I mean, there is one point when, Leonardo gets noticed by the Marchioness of Mantua, Isabella d'Este, who's a big art collector. And she said, I really want a portrait. She's writing to her agent saying, can you get me a portrait? And she doesn't get a portrait. She ends up with just a drawing. But, you know, there are a lot of people competing to hire Leonardo. But he also puts himself forward. So he writes letters. There's a very interesting letter that he writes to the Duke of Milan offering his services. And 9 out of 10 of these services are about the type of military advice and techniques that he can provide. And only at the end he said, oh, and in peacetime, by the way, I can also do art and architecture. And he designs a bridge. He designs a bridge across the for Istanbul and sends the sends a letter over to the Sultan saying, would you be interested in this? So there's a lot of really interesting pitching for work, as well as waiting around for possible commissions.
The original freelancer.
Yeah, absolutely.
So is it right that it's for the Duke of Milan that he creates the Last Supper as well?
Well, that's for a particular church in Milan. So it's not a direct, but it's while he's in Milan working for the Duke. So it's connected with that period of his work. So even when you are working for one court and based at one court, you might be taking on jobs for different clients in the same city.
Right, yeah. So clearly plenty going on in Leonardo's life, and lots of, is it fair to say instability, I suppose, with these different courts? But one aspect of the programme that we were going to talk about today is the way that the drama chooses to portray also his personal life alongside his artistic and engineering work. So what is known about Leonardo's private relationships?
Well, this is a really, really challenging subject, because the actual detailed evidence we have for Leonardo in terms of his lovers from his own lifetime is very, very scanty indeed. So we really have one document, and this is from 1476, and it is an anonymous denunciation of Leonardo and 4 other men to the Florentine authorities on the charge of sodomy. So this anonymous individual writes a message, puts it in the anonymous denunciations box pretty much, and says that Leonardo, who at the time was just short of his 24th birthday, along with a chap called Bartolomeo, who's a goldsmith, a chap called Bacino, who's a tailor, and a guy called Leonardo Tornabuoni, who's from quite a wealthy, well-known family in Florence, have been engaging in sodomy with a 17-year-old man called Jacopo Saltarelli, who appears to be a sex worker. He has a previous offence on record. And Saltarelli is described as being a party to many wretched affairs and consents to please these persons who exact certain evil pleasures from him. So Leonardo there is accused of having sex with men, which is against the law. Now, this anonymous denunciation is not actually accepted by the authorities. Now, it used to be the case that people said this wasn't accepted because the Tornabuoni family had political influence, and so they got them off. But actually now, I think most historians think that the reason is simply because, as an anonymous denunciation, it didn't fit the requirements. Although you were allowed to make these denunciations secretly without your name becoming public, you did have to sign them. And because this one wasn't signed, there was a bit of an investigation. It was ruled out of order, and the group were told, you're absolved of these allegations, provided you don't get reported again. So it's a little bit like being let off with a police caution. So we know this is going to stay on record, but we're not going to, you know, rule either way whether or not you were guilty of it. We're just going to say, look, we don't want to hear from you again. We don't So that's what we know. And of course, so this immediately, I guess, in terms of what we know about Leonardo, given that this is the only very solid piece of evidence, leans us in the direction that he's more interested in men than he is in women. Now, what we do need to be a little bit careful about, though, is that in this period, we do not, well, two things really. One, there are not very solid distinctions of identity between people who are gay and straight. Those are much, much more modern, really don't come in until the 20th century. And so that's part of the story, that we shouldn't assume that because somebody is having sex with men, they would have an identity as gay or bisexual. That's something that people do rather than something that people think they are. And secondly, most men in Florence were having sex with other men at some point in their lives. And this is what the extraordinary pieces of history about 15th century Florence is, that we know from the remarkable work in Michael Rocker's book, Forbidden Friendships, which came out now 25 years ago, that when you look at the police lists of this Office of the Night, which is a magistracy set up specifically to try and, you know, deal with issues of vice, really, like a little bit like a Florentine vice squad, runs over the 70 years from 1432 to 1502. If you look at the records for the later part of the 15th century, more than half the men in Florence appear at some point in the lists. Now, doesn't mean that they were all necessarily did exactly the thing they were accused of doing. No. Doesn't mean that there was a general culture in Florence in which, despite it being illegal, lots of people were having same-sex affairs, same-sex one-night stands, same-sex relationships. Yes. So this is very much an accepted part of Florentine male culture. The penalties are quite small. People don't go to jail until they're on a kind of fourth offence or so, as you see in the case of Leonardo. There are charges that aren't pursued. So if he was indeed sleeping with Jacopo Saltarelli or any other young man, this would be very much within the sort of accepted paradigm of what a 24-year-old unmarried man in Florence might well be doing.
Okay, interesting. So even notwithstanding that, there's obviously not a legal fallout there for Leonardo. Do we know if there was any other impact? In the piece you've written for History Extra, you mentioned there's a certain amount of religious hostility that goes with those kind of accusations.
Yeah, I mean, there is some suggestion that later on, in the 1490s, so by the time now we're in kind of a point where Leonardo is into his 40s, one of the reasons that he's actually not that enthusiastic about staying in Florence or working in Florence is that between 1494 and 1498, which is a period after the Italian Wars have begun. So from 1494 onwards, that's kind of really the second half of Leonardo's career, is dominated by this big series of wars. In the context of those wars, which kind of European level war that happened to be going on in Italy, the Florentine government, sort of pro-Medici family government, gets kicked out and goes into exile. And in its place comes a government which is very politically dominated by a Dominican friar called Girolamo Savonarola, who's quite a hellfire preacher. One of the things that he really does is sort of say, you know, we really need to address the problem of sodomy in Florence. I mean, there are all sorts of, you know, crackdown on sexual misconduct, all these things very bad for the city. And so in that context, religious hostility might be a factor in why Leonardo was not enthused about prospect of being in Florence at that point. But again, we're sort of into the realms of speculation. We don't know that. Leonardo didn't write lots of details about what he thought about sex. People have had to sort of speculate on it. And I mean, starting from Freud, Freud onwards, Freud writes this whole thing about a childhood dream that Leonardo has and invents all these speculations around it, partly based on mistranslation, which is kind of unfortunate. But so lots of people are speculating, but really with very little, very concrete evidence about what might have been going on.
Right. There's also another relationship of significance that you've written about for History Extra, and this is with the artist known as Salai. What can you say, what's known about, and what's there for speculation with Leonardo's relationship with Salai?
So Salai, who's proper name is Gian Giacomo Caprotti, although he's never really called that in the sources. He is later in a kind of rather fictional account of Leonardo, written in the later 16th century, so after everybody's death, but still within living memory. He is described as being a lover of Leonardo. So this is in a dialogue by Giampaolo Lomazzo, who lived from 1536 to 1584. He identifies this as being a sexual relationship. And so he writes this fictional conversation between a character called Phidias and Leonardo, and they talk about, and Leonardo says that he's had sex with Salai many times, and he says, have in mind that he was a most beautiful young man, especially at about 15. And so when you start, like, Salai being about 15, might be something that would raise alarm bells with modern listeners. And in fact, this is, we know that Salai joined Leonardo's household at the age of 10, which would even more raise alarm bells with modern listeners. And actually, that is quite a typical pattern of same-sex relationships in Florence in this period. This is kind of what you might call a pederastic model, which follows the model that's common in the ancient world of an older man. I mean, in this case, you know, when Salai is 15, Leonardo is 43. So quite, it's a very, very big age gap. But quite often you find in these records that we have from Florence that when prosecutions are taking place, the younger man will on average be around 15 or 16, and with a kind of age spread of sort of 12 to 13 and through to 18 or 20. And this is a model that they think at the time is it almost a kind of, you know, educational type of relationship for the younger person concerned. Again, it's something that now, of course, is enormously taboo, but actually persisted in European culture for a very, very long time. I mean, it's an ancient model, but I mean, right through until the 20th century, you find these cases of people, you know, being quite tolerated by their circles of friends, even while having relationships, if we could call it that, with teenage boys. So clearly, when we come back to the idea of a TV series, this is, of course, tremendously difficult material for a TV series to deal with in a way that was historically accurate, and partly because we just don't know what's going on, and I don't want to be the person to label Leonardo as possibly abusing his 10-year-old servant boy. And perhaps partly for that reason, people have been quite reluctant to be concrete about whether or not it's a sexual relationship and at what point it might have been a sexual relationship. What we do know is that it's a very long relationship. And having joined this household in 1490, Salai stays around almost until Leonardo's death, so a good 25 years or so. So this is not only a relationship when he's a teenager. It is something that lasts well into his own adulthood. So again, all you know, this is one of these things where we're entirely in the grounds of hearsay, extrapolation from circumstances, and trying to understand a model of sexuality that is quite alien to society today. When we get to it. But it's one of those quite tricky things to deal with, just because on the one hand, you know, it can be quite tempting to want to look back into the past and claim prominent figures as gay or bisexual and kind of sort of say, well, these people are, you know, part of our history. And on the other hand, sometimes when you do that, as in this case, you hit up against some quite difficult facts and realities of the contemporary perceptions of what constitutes an acceptable sort of relationship. It was actually it's more taboo back in the 15th and 16th century for two adult men to be having an equal relationship with one another than it is for an adult man to be having a relationship with a teenage boy, which is completely like the opposite to what we think is okay now. But it is more transgressive for, two adult men to be having sex on a kind of equal basis. So yeah, they have such different attitudes to what is okay.
Right. So yes, definitely understandable that the drama has chosen to perhaps make Leonardo and Salai more equal in age for the purpose of the drama. And I'm interested in your opinion of the drama's take in general. They do obviously portray him as a gay man, and I think, do you think this will be surprising for modern audiences, or do you think that this aspect of his private life and his relationships is well known?
So, as I say, people have been talking about it going back at least to Freud. I mean, so it's not that it hasn't been out there. It's been treated kind of differently in some of the modern biographies. So Walter Isaacson's biography is very much kind of portrays Leonardo as very definitely gay. Some people have said in a somewhat anachronistic way. On the other hand, I think Charles Nichols leans towards talking about the possibility that Leonardo has sex with women. And so there's a little bit of tension there. It does get, but you know, it certainly does come up. In the recent exhibitions that I've seen, the sodomy trial tends to be mentioned, but often because we don't have more solid evidence. After that, you tend to end up saying, we just don't know. We don't know the nature of these later relationships. We don't know whether, you know, having been put on trial once, investigated once, Leonardo then sort of thought, better be extremely discreet because I don't want to get into trouble. Whether he just decided he actually wasn't all that interested in sex. There are a couple of quotations that suggest he's not that keen. But again, you don't know whether these are, you can take these out of, what context those fit in. Are they a kind of one-off thought or are they a life philosophy? We can't tell. So, you again end up sort of extrapolating huge amounts from tiny, tiny fragments of evidence. But I think that if you haven't read a recent biography or if you haven't seen a recent exhibition where that's been flagged, you may be quite surprised. Because actually this sort of this whole history of Renaissance sexuality is something that, yeah, the specialists know about it. It's in the academic books, but, you know, whether it's really got out there into the broader image of Leonardo among people at large, I'm not quite sure.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
The interesting thing about Mona Lisa is that Francesco Dal Giocondo never gets his painting. Although she, the painting exists, Leonardo doesn't hand it over.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
So in the drama, the show also chooses to depict a woman, Caterina da Cremona, as a significant figure in Leonardo's life. Where does she come from in this story? And more broadly, what's kind of known about his relationships with any women potentially?
Well, she is a bit of a fictional composite. So I don't think anybody has claimed that she's a real person. But there are obviously a number of women with whom Leonardo works and engages. So there are women who are patrons, there are women at court, there are some women whose names appear in his financial records, and of course there are the models, because Leonardo draws women. So one of the kind of questions that does come up is there any woman amongst all these individuals who may have been a potential lover? Because everybody likes it. Everybody wants to have an affair, and maybe, you know, this is a kind of neat, this is a neat way of speculating. So there have been a few pieces of speculation, although there's even less evidence for Leonardo having sex with a woman than there is for him having sex with a man. And as we've seen, there's not very much evidence in a really, really solid way for that. So at the end of the day, though, I suppose what I would say about it is that this again brings us back to the question of fluidity of sexuality. And I mean, these days, if somebody identifies as gay and then they suddenly start going out with a member of the opposite sex, their friends are probably going to be a little bit like, whoa, what's going on here? This is all a bit of a shock. And, you know, and vice versa, right? A sudden kind of coming out in one direction or the other is typically a surprise. Whereas I think in the Renaissance, with those ideas not being so solid, and there not being an assumption about sort of quite the innate nature of somebody as being gay or bisexual or straight, they would probably be a little bit less surprised by it. And also perhaps even a little bit more likely to do it because it's not so challenging to your internal identity.
Right. That makes sense. I wonder, jumping off that, can we talk a bit about the women that Leonardo painted, or just in terms of the women who feature in his paintings, perhaps Mona Lisa, just as she's the most obvious candidate?
Yeah, I mean, Mona Lisa is a really interesting one because originally, I mean, Lisa del Giocondo, maiden name is Lisa Gherardini, she is the wife of this quite sharp-elbowed Florentine businessman, Francesco del Giocondo, who evidently, like a lot of kind of businessmen in the period, is quite upwardly mobile and sees having a portrait of his wife by one of the local star artists as being an attractive thing to do. And presumably at some point commissions Leonardo. And the interesting thing about Mona Lisa is that Francesco del Giocondo never gets his painting. Although she, the painting exists, Leonardo doesn't hand it over. He takes it off to Paris with him when he moves to work for the King of France. And there is, an argument, Martin Kemp's argument, that by the end of its existence, this isn't really a portrait of a real woman anymore. It's actually quite idealized. So there's a sort of question about what's going on there with that portrait, whether that's a real Lisa or whether it's not. Leonardo does a drawing of Isabella d'Este, the Marchioness of Mantua. As I say, she wants a portrait. She didn't get one. There are a number of drawings for Leda and the Swan, very kind of classical, famous classical subject. There are portraits of the Virgin Child with St. Anne. There are lots of Virgin Marys. So there are lots of portraits and paintings of different types of women by Leonardo. But again, these are, how can we connect these with real life women? Well, even in the case of Mona Lisa, where there's some connection with a real life woman, the end product seems to have shifted somewhat from that. And as I say, there are some very lovely portraits, but it's difficult to connect that into what's going on in his actual private life.
Right. We've talked a fair bit now about his private life and where there are gaps and kind of opportunities for speculation. And the drama, obviously, as period drama does, is, plays on these areas of speculation and creates a narrative out of that. But I imagine many of our listeners will be kind of fired up to find out a bit more about him. Where can people go to find out more about the real Leonardo and his work?
Oh, well, gosh, there are all sorts of books out there. There's a very nice recent one that I reviewed, which is very, very detailed, deconstructing the myths around the Mona Lisa. That's by Martin Kemp and Giuseppe Pallanti. That's called The Mona Lisa, The People and the Painting. So if you, and they have done this remarkable job of trying to get behind all the speculation that has been created about that particular painting and its patrons and about Leonardo's early life. And they do some really valuable work in identifying what's likely to be his real birthplace. Spoiler, it's not the place where the birthplace museum is, which is a slightly demolished the whole premise for that museum, which is awkward. And that book is also the one that first brought to light the evidence about Mona Lisa's husband being involved in slave trading. So lots of fascinating and quite a dense read sometimes, but lots of fascinating detail of the facts there. There's a really good fun book by Paul Strathen called The Artist, the Warrior and the Philosopher, which looks at the events that happened when Leonardo and Machiavelli and Cesare Borgia were all in the same place at the same time. So that's very interesting if you want something that looks at the warfare in more detail and Leonardo's work on that side of things. There's lots of material out there. If you want to know more about sexuality and particularly same-sex relationships, then obviously Forbidden Friendships is one place to start. There's also a great new recent book called Same-Sex Marriage in Renaissance Rome by Gary Ferguson, which looks at the case of a group of male friends who were in various combinations of sexual relationships in this kind of little subculture in later 16th century Rome. All of those things are out there. I have some references to them in my book if you want a kind of quick introduction, but then there are plenty of places to go to dig in more detail.
Fantastic. I mean, well, you've already mentioned that there are so many sources where people can go to find out more. And the drama, if people want to go and watch it and see how that depicts Leonardo's life, that's available on Amazon Prime in the UK and Ireland at the moment. And Catherine, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about Leonardo da Vinci.
Thanks for having me.
That was Catherine Fletcher. Her latest book, The Beauty and the Terror, An Alternative History of the Italian Renaissance, is published by Bodley Head and is out now. There's a link in the show notes. If you want to read more from Catherine on Leonardo's relationships, you can read her article on this at historyextra.com/Leonardo-relationships. And for a bonus podcast recorded with Frank Spotnitz and Steve Thompson, the writers of the new drama series on Leonardo da Vinci, then visit historyextra.com/Leonardo-TV-podcast. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman and Brittany Colley. Join us tomorrow for the extraordinary story of a World War II secret agent.